Good morning. Welcome to the House Interim Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. It's Wednesday, January 13th. We have a busy agenda, and happy that you're all here to be part of our conversations today. We're going to start with a work session to introduce our committee bills. As the committee knows, in case the audience doesn't, in the short session, each committee gets to introduce three bills. We have three concepts that we will hopefully introduce here in a moment. One caveat that we always mention is that introduction, support of a motion I hope will be forthcoming to introduce these bills as committee bills, does not indicate that any individual member will support them once they become bills. We don't even know if those bills will come back to this committee, but we think they are, at least I think they're worthy concepts, and we've talked about them in the committee before. Just so that people know about them, the three that are in play here are a very technical set of adjustments that the HEC, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, is seeking. That's LC 182. LC 183 relates to the Oregon Growth Board that we've talked about extensively in the committee, related to the Growth Board's ability to invest in funds. And finally, LC 184 would ask the State Treasurer to conduct a study around the refinancing of student debt based on some things that we've seen other states pursue. So those are the three that we're talking about. With that, Representative Wisnett.
Chair Reed, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 182 dated 12-23-15. LC 183 dated 12-8-15. LC 184 dated 1-5-16.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett moves that LC 182 dated 12-23-15, LC 183 dated 12-8-15, and LC 184 dated 1-5-16 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries, and the three LCs be introduced as committee bills. Thank you for the work session on committee bill introduction, and proceed to the rest of our agenda. Open an informational meeting on university governance. We appreciate the continuation of that conversation, and we have, fortunately, we have four chairs. So, if you'd all like to come forward, Pat Reeser, do we still call you Senator? Senator Nelson, Ross Carey, and Swati Adarkar. I hope I've got the pronunciation something close. I know you'll correct me as you're getting settled. Just to pick up, we were interested in our last meeting, just getting perspectives on how the implementation of university governance is going. I don't think we're needing the as much of the specific day-to-day sort of stuff, but just sort of a check-in for us to see if things are progressing as we had hoped and what your perspectives are on our progress. We appreciated hearing one set of perspectives in the last meeting. I'm glad that you're here to continue that conversation today. I expect you have some plan as to who's going to go in what order, and we're happy to hear from you and whatever makes sense from your perspective. Please start by introducing yourself for our record, and we're glad to hear your testimony. Thanks.
I'll start. My name is Ross Carey. I'm on the board of the University of Oregon. I'm an Oregon graduate, 2 degrees actually from Oregon. I am the chair of the Finance and Facilities Committee at the University of Oregon.
Good morning, Pat Reeser, chair of the Oregon State University Board. I also am a graduate of Oregon State, and also have a degree from Portland State.
So, David Nelson, I'm the chair of the Board of Trustees for Eastern Oregon University. I'm representing the four trues, as they call them, the technicals, reasonables.
Good morning. I'm Swati Adarkar. I'm on the PSU board.
Yes. Chair Reed and fellow representatives, this morning, I want to share a little bit about the tremendous effort that each board has put forth as we accepted the responsibilities of the new governance system. And even though my experience lies with the OSU board, I speak on behalf of all of us in general terms. But I would ask you to note that this Friday marks the 2-year anniversary of the first orientation session that Oregon State's Board of Trustees held. And it's been a very busy 2 years since that orientation. And upon the convening, we certainly had to take action on the university budget, because timing and calendar don't always mesh the way assignments payments are made. But in addition to that, we've secured our own bond rating, as have each one of the universities. And we've identified a number of projects that will be financed by that revenue bond sale. While meeting these urgent needs, we've also been setting up this, setting up the stage for long-term governance. And we've looked at samples of from AGB, from other universities. We've done bylaws. We have board policies. We've set standards for evaluating and compensating our presidents. And we've established relationships with all of our governing partners. And I must apologize. When you have oral surgery, you end up with a piece of putty in your mouth. And so every so often, I just have to get it in place. So no, excuse me.
No problem.
That's just the way it is.
No problem.
But while it's been a very busy time, it's been a very rewarding time. On our particular board, as many of the others, we cover the state in terms of our membership, and we also go beyond the state. But this board is composed of people who truly care about the university, and we take very seriously our charge, not only to serve our university, but to serve the United, the state of Oregon. And of course, being a land-grant university, we take that charge very, very seriously. Now, my philosophy as a chair going into this was we needed to be, as a board, very kind to ourselves and give ourselves permission to learn as we move through. Having said that, we have been extremely strategic in our process. We've looked to working very closely with our president in establishing the governance standards. And we've looked closely at AGB and, as I mentioned, other universities in addition to the universities within our states. We've compared notes. We collaborate closely with our other board members. And we also listen to our community. We've established the practice of inviting public comment on any action before the board votes on it. And we listen and then work to respond to the concerned chairs. As an example, we had a number of graduate students come to our board with issues about their graduate teaching assistantships. And working with our president and our provost, we were able to address those needs to the satisfaction of both parties. And in all of our efforts, we not only look at taking care of our fiduciary means, but we also look at the responsibility of serving the university as a whole. And I feel very honored to serve in this capacity for the Oregon State University. And
please. It's excellent having a senator there, a pro who can instruct people. These are very sensitive mics, so you don't have to be very close to them. Thank you for the assist.
Chair Reed and committee members, I just want to begin by thanking you for making the time to have this check-in and hear from us. Obviously, this is a very new chapter as we look at what higher ed needs to be, where we sit now and in the future, and a different level of engagement across the state. I also really want to thank you for the investment that was made in higher education in the 2015 session. It's really critical, and for my personal, just speaking personally, the reason I agreed to be on the PSU board was a very deep belief in the education continuum of Oregon. I spend my day job is focused on early childhood education, the earlier end of the education continuum, but I believe very strongly that the higher ed piece is another critical piece, particularly as we're seeing the achievement gap. And what I believe is the opportunity of our boards represented here today is the chance to get get much more engaged and committed to make sure we're reaching more students. And so I think that 2015 investment is a beginning, hopefully, of increasing and sustained investments to make sure we can all fulfill the vision for kids being successful. The boards have really had an exciting opportunity to learn about higher ed, to learn about shared governance, and to figure out right-sizing and calibrating our place as trustees in this shared governance system. And I think what's been fabulous is the chance to be supporting the mission and to be working with a diverse set of colleagues on all the boards. We come to it to represent the whole university community, and yet we all have varying perspectives. On the PSU board, we have the business community, we have alumni, we have students, we have faculty. I represent a community seat, but I think that rich collective of perspectives is giving us a chance to keep the North Star firmly in mind in terms of high quality higher ed. And so I think we all represent that chance to come at it from different point of views, but hold the vision firmly in place. An example of that collective work at PSU has been an 18-month process resulting in a new strategic plan for the university, and it was a very inclusive process, deep level of engagement, including the board. And what I think was really reflective about the shared governance were the changes, modifications, adjustments made as students raised issues, as faculty raised issues, and the board sits then in a place to help the university think about how to execute on that mission at the strategic level, and to think about how we meet our fiduciary responsibilities at the same time. I think OSU's plan, for a 10-year business plan to support the strategic plan, is another example of the board sort of getting engaged at that strategic level. And if you think about it, none of us that are on these independent boards were connected to higher ed in the same way. We had individual voices, but now we're helping to build a sturdy and stable system for the state of Oregon. The other thing I think that's exciting is even though we have independent boards, we're keeping our eye on collaboration. I think one of the things that we all committed to was strong universities, but a strong system. And I think that can be best represented by the university presidents all having worked together this last session on the investment and collective good, and some of the other problem solving that the university teams have put their brains together to figure out how we advance individual missions but make sure the system is strong. And so, you know, I think all of that takes a new scope of learning, and as I said before, sort of calibrating to how we appropriately deliver on our assignment. But I feel really good about the progress to date, and I think the journey is unfolding, but I feel really good about the shared commitment to higher ed as a system and strong independent organizations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I would like to just make a few comments on the financial oversight and execution of our fiduciary duty as board members at each of the institutions. Key responsibility of the university's boards, as it was of OUS, was that oversight and monitoring of financial management and controls at the universities. Each institution having a dedicated board allows greater level of rigor and detail, greater understanding of the financial dynamics of a complex institution like a university than was possible with OUS governing all seven institutions. But we're able to have robust discussions about long-term financial stability. Again, something that each board is doing individually, and OUS probably didn't have the bandwidth to do at a greater level of depth across all seven universities that were very different. Two of the primary responsibilities of the boards are approval of a budget and tuition recommendations. Very sensitive issues. The budget clearly is the primary input into the tuition recommendation. Consequently, one of our board's focuses, as with all of the other board's focus, is to work with administration to ensure resources are deployed effectively and efficiently in order to keep tuition increases as reasonable as possible while still providing extremely high-quality educational opportunities. In general, with university boards, individual university boards, the universities are more nimble and better able to identify opportunities to reallocate resources to better align with the academic mission of the university and of the state. It's greater fiscal accountability generally. While trustees don't manage the institution, we hold it accountable and ensure resource allocation aligns with missions. For example, one area where I think there's far greater diligence and review, each board has described audit responsibilities for an internal audit function. The materiality threshold for each university by itself is lower than it was for OUS in their internal audit reviews, and therefore we're able to dig in and identify opportunities for creating efficiency. Our internal audit staff works closely with administration and staff across campus to identify opportunities to improve controls or operate more efficiently, and those efforts and cooperation are already yielding dividends. So I said previously, each institution having individual boards to evaluate and improve tuition and budgets. There's more attention to how universities spend dollars, family and taxpayer dollars, and this coupled with HEC's focus on outcomes for funding is without question a benefit to students. I welcome the opportunity to answer any questions about our review and oversight of and execution of our fiduciary duty, but I think we've taken a big step forward in adding a level of scrutiny to how state resources are being deployed in higher education in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll hold questions, so we'll hear from Senator Nelson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson. I live in Pendleton, Oregon. I'm the chair of the Eastern Oregon University Board of Trustees and served in the Oregon Senate for 16 years, retiring about 4 or 5 years ago. I've lost track of that time someplace along the line. But again, thank you, and I think it's been said here before, you know, for taking care of higher education in the last session. What we're looking at, I think, from at least the TRU's viewpoint, that's a technical and regional universities, this is our first year into this process. We just came on July 1st. The big three are basically every year and a half into this. So we're doing really very well. This is a very good program. I think this is a real significant change for education in Oregon. And it's, as was said, it's a learning process for us, but we're doing really, really, really well. I talked with Lisa Graham, who is the chair of the Oregon Institute of Technology, Jim Baumgartner, who is the chair of Western, he's an attorney in Portland, and Bill Thorndike, who is from Medford, the chair of Southern Oregon University. And their reaction is that this is a very good process that we're going through. This is really good because you're getting this local control. We do have some concerns, and we'll get into this as we come into this. I'm just to let you know how they are, but it's defining the rules and the concept of shared governance. You know, in the past, it was always the president's office, the faculty, the staff, whatever going on. But now with the boards, we're part of that shared governance of the university, and in fact, you as the legislature are part of that too. And HEC is part of that because you have control. When we talk about tuition, we've got to come to you and say, okay, how are we going to work out this tuition situation? Because you have final say, as I say. But shared governance, from our view, is not equal shared governance. What we're saying is that we, as the Board of Trustees, are the governing board. The buck stops with us. If our institutions don't succeed, it's our fault. And so what we're asking, I think, from the legislature and from HEC, is to stay on a more strategic level. You have in front of you this thing from this Association of Governing Boards, and the thing is keeper of the larger vision. If not trustees, then who? Well, I think you could say that for the legislature, too. If not, who is keeper of the larger vision? You know, is education really important? So where do you put that on the spectrum of things? And so it is a continuing spectrum. It goes to the pre-K. You know, because we have a lot of remedial classes, I think. Isn't that one of the issues that our boards are dealing with? Remedial classes, kids aren't prepared to come into school. So, and that comes down to basically what I look at, what Oregon law's done is made Eastern into a private institution with our largest donor is the state of Oregon. I mean, it's maybe not exactly a private institution, but our largest donor is you folks. And so we need your help, particularly on a financial aspect of this, because we live in a different geographical area where we have more rural students. Poverty is probably more widespread, although maybe that's not true either, because you get some areas of Portland it's a huge areas of poverty. But it's one of those things that if you don't give people access to education, what good are they going to do? They're going to end up in prison. There's going to be more health care problems. To me, the priority is education. And that's where we should go. This thing will show that there are basically they're looking at three long-term, big-time strategic things that all of us should be looking at. And we should look at it as partners with you, isn't it? And the first one is responsibility to a larger society. Do we want a well-educated populace? Well, that's a question you guys are going to have to answer. Okay, if you're going to say yes, then what do we have to do to get there? The second part of it is, how do we ensure long-range financial health? And I know that's a big concern because you have a huge amount of demands on money and there's a limited pile of money. So, and I think Ross indicated that, you know, we're working on those things. I don't think we are boards as such as fundraisers. We're not here to just to contribute money to the university. We're here as boards to govern. We may get involved in the fundraising. There's no question about that. But our first priority is to be a governance board, that we have the final responsibility. And then the third thing is to address the public skepticism on the value of higher education, because you're having a lot of people now saying, why would I send my son or daughter to a school, spend $50,000 or $100,000, and they don't have a job when they come out? And, of course, academia looks at it and says, well, you're going to be a better person. So there's a disconnect between what the institution is thinking and what the parent is thinking or the student is thinking. And so we have to – how do we come to those things? And so what we're doing at Eastern, basically, is we're looking at this thing, and if you read this thing, this is just an outline. There's actually a 30-page report for it. And so what we've done, and we've got actually a very interesting board member, is a fellow that's a retired Microsoft guy. His name is Bill Johnson. And if you think Excel back in the early days, he was one of the project managers of Excel. So he's on our board of directors. So he creates all these spreadsheets. And so we have nothing but spreadsheets. And so we have seven specific things based upon this article that we're looking at as a board that we're going to address on big strategic items. We're trying to stay out of the weeds, basically, in how to run the university. That's kind of where the direction. I think that's the direction that most of these boards are going to go, because the expertise comes from those folks that we hire to run the university. But we have to make sure that there's accountability. I have some thoughts on accountability, too. Accountability is expensive. Does it have value? I think that's the question. And I was looking at the HEC agenda for tomorrow. They've got five reports that they're talking about that came basically as a result of action from the legislature. I don't know, is there going to be any good coming out of those reports? There may be, I don't know. But I think that's what we have to look at. What is the value? And in the final analysis, what we have to do as universities, we have to create a product that people are willing to spend money for. It's really kind of a business model. And the product is these students. And so how are we going to give them the best education at a reasonable cost? And I think that's the direction we're going to go as boards. And this whole concept is really, really good, I think. Wouldn't you agree that these reasonable boards, it's going to work. It's really going to work. So, That's my two cents, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much. We appreciate all of you being here. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Gallegos, please.
Yeah, I had a question. I guess I'm trying to I'm thinking about representation on the boards, and my understanding from your introductions are that you are none of you are faculty or staff, or we've had students come up already, but is that correct?
That's correct.
Faculty or staff are not represented here in this panel.
That's right.
And I guess that's something I'd like to hear from faculty and staff. How do you incorporate their input into the decision making that you're talking about? Any one of you?
Well, let me go ahead and comment. At the University of Oregon, we have found the input from our faculty and staff and student board members extremely valuable as we've gone through deliberations on some very challenging issues. One of those, obviously, tuition. Our former student trustee ended up resigning and actually made some comments that didn't feel like her input was respected. I feel personally that I respected her input a great deal, and I know that all of my colleagues that I've spoken with have respected her input a great deal. In fact, when we were considering our tuition increase proposal last year, she proposed an amendment which would have reduced the tuition increase, created a large amount of debate and discussion about the numbers that went into the proposal. She got a lot of support out of other trustees, and I think everybody respected a great deal the way she managed that situation. Ultimately, it did not pass. Her amendment did not pass, but it was a very close vote, and it only did not pass because, frankly, the numbers wouldn't work when you really dug into it. She also provided a huge amount of quality input that resulted in positive changes to student conduct code. So we've always felt that that input was very valuable. Likewise, our faculty trustee provides incredibly valuable input on shared governance, relationship with faculty, issues with faculty. And beyond the role of the trustees representing the campus community, at each of our board meetings, we try to have separate breakout meetings with volunteers from students or faculty or staff where we'll have lunch. A couple trustees will have lunch with a group of, say, 10 faculty and just have an unscripted, no agenda dialogue where they have opportunities to ask us questions and we have an opportunity to hear what they have on their mind. And those are some of the most valuable interactions that we have, and we're all committed to continuing to do those as much as possible. So,
follow up. Nice. Yeah, ask if anybody else wants to hear first, or do you want to follow up? Go ahead, follow up, please.
Well, yeah, let me follow up. I really appreciate Mr. Easter's comment about collaborative leadership and collaboration, and I know that can get messy, and that the one principle of collaborative leadership is appreciating diversity. Diversity of opinions, and your decision making is much richer because of that. So that's why I'm interested in making sure that we've got diversity of opinion and diversity of input into the governing boards. My understanding, or at least I heard that particular student was replaced by a freshman, and I think that just seems a little interesting to me in that, for example, we've got other perspectives in the academia, for example, graduate TAs, for example, who are sort of a hybrid of student and staff. So I guess the struggle that I'm thinking about and recognizing your service and appreciating your service, I can't help but think about how do we really capture the real breadth of diversity that we really need, not just to look at the financial accountability of our institutions, but also the output in terms of the kind of graduate students and the kind of graduates that we need in these universities. It isn't just about financial accountability, it's also about how do we really get the kind of graduates that we need to fill our workforce. Thank you.
I'd like to share just an incident we had with our previous student representative. When we were in the discussion of tuition, and it was a very robust, we had folks who spoke to the group prior to, when it actually came down to a vote, you could see the question and answer and the argument going on in this young man's head. And he said, I know what my fellow students feel, but now that I'm sitting in this position and I see the overall picture, mm-hmm. I have to vote because for the tuition that we had established or that was up for vote, because I know that's the only way the university can keep providing what we want. And that was, and he was a senior, but that was the difference between having enough experience in a setting, in the university setting, and understanding all that goes into it. So I just wanted to counter that we had that experience.
I'll just add a little bit. I think we're all facing a very complex role, which is we're trying to shore up and build sustainability and the long-term vision for universities that do not yet have adequate funding. I'm a believer that this is a public responsibility, and so we come into it where no one constituency can solve that problem. Graduate students, if we had a whole graduate student and faculty governance structure, that wouldn't solve the problem. It wouldn't solve the problem if it was all business folks. So, you know, at some point we've got to figure out how to lift together. And I guess the concept of not having discrete slots forces a sort of more collective approach to this, which is doesn't mean we know how to do it from the get-go. But just speaking from my own experience on the PSU board, we're not making decisions about the curriculum, about academic guidance, about all that whole area in which we would, of course, defer to the wisdom of the faculty and the academic senate process. And so I think that's what shared governance is supposed to be about. And then the question is, how can we leverage our respective strengths? For example, you know, I don't think anyone is looking to me. My background is not financial. I run a nonprofit, so I can bring that perspective. But there are several board members who have deep audit experience, and I can rely on them. I listen to the students for other pieces of it. And so the question is, how can we exercise good judgment? And how do we make sure there's an input process that doesn't support narrow thinking? And I do think that having public comment, having open committees, all of that is a very important part, just as it is for you to hear from the public. And so I think, you know, I see a deep commitment to that. At the same time, I think we're figuring out how do you make sure you're really hearing from people and attending to it. But I feel like there's a deep commitment among all the trustees on the PSU board to care about it, to be concerned about it, and to struggle with how do we make sure we're delivering at a strategic level and appreciate the role of the different constituencies.
Another consideration I think you have to make is, and this is David Nelson, the fact that I can identify at least 10 interest groups on our campus at Eastern, smaller campus. We can't have one person for each one of those groups on our board. We have probably five. You know, we have faculty, students, the classified staff. We have a thing called University Council, which most universities don't have. They don't have a representation on the board. And our board, we have more of a geographical issue, I think, than maybe Portland. We go stretch from the Idaho border clear through, probably not maybe, maybe to the Dalles, kind of that. It's 200, 250 miles. So we do a geographical, but we also do ethnic too. I mean, we have a Roberta Connors, who's an enrolled member of the Confederated Tribes. We have two fellas, George Mendoza and Abel Mendoza, who are from Latino descent. Because we have huge Hispanic populations on in the Ontario Valley and in the Hermiston area. And so, I mean, I think when you have to put some trust in us too, that's we're going to look at the look at people that are going to do the best job for us. I mean, we're the buck stops with us at the very end. When you come right down to it, we have a lot of responsibility. And so we're going to, you know, we're just not going to fly off and do some things and not listen to people. We're going to take care of business and make sure that our universities are successful.
I'd like to add one more comment.
Sure.
I think we're developing this sense of trust. After the students spoke to us about their tuition concern, we changed the calendar, or rather the university. We asked the university to change the calendar when they would put that item open for discussion on campus, so there would be plenty of time for all the dialogue that needs to happen. In terms of the graduate students, it was almost that first time a fear reaction, a rumor got started. And we were able to clear that up, get better communication to the deans so they in turn could pass it on to their graduate students. So I believe it's really important that we're given the opportunity to develop the processes where trust, so as trustees, we can also be trusted.
Representative Johnson, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you all for being here. Really, this is a important, I think, report for this committee to hear, because this committee has been responsible for putting in place a lot of the governance changes that you all are now experiencing. So it's great for some of us that have a chance to be a part of those discussions and part of that legislation to hear firsthand how things are going. But I wanted to focus in on a comment that I think you were making, Senator, about keep the financial resources coming, but don't butt into our business, if I'm just paraphrasing your comments. And I hear that. And I mean, I'm not being critical, but I hear that because, you know, at the point in time we establish the institutional boards, we want you to be autonomous strategic boards, being able to make decisions that you all feel, with the sum total of who you put on those boards, decisions that are in the best interest of your institution so that you can truly be strategic boards and don't have to necessarily be managed by another governance oversight board as we were in the past. But one of the benefits that was advertised, it was hoped for, in giving you all your autonomy and the strategic authority would be increased philanthropy, being able to fundraise in a way that you perhaps couldn't when you were part of the OUS system. But now that you've got the keys to the car, so to speak, and you can drive and do what you feel is in the best interest of both your institution and the state of Oregon, how is that going? What kind of reports can you give us about the increase in philanthropy that in turn should not just be enough to, you know, keep the mission of the university on track, but result in lower tuition, better resources for students, and some of those things too. So you don't all have to comment, but if somebody feels like you have something to share about that, I'd be interested in hearing what you have.
Well, before we were granted the authority, we started Oregon State launched their campaign, and you know, it's history. We started out with a goal of $625 million that almost frightened all of us. How in the world would that happen? At that time, I was serving on the OSU Foundation. We reached that goal prior to our time that we expected to in which to work it. So we had a very big debate and moved it up to $825. When we blew past that, we said, okay, we're going for the billion. But along the way, I could see foundation members looking at the university and noting their academic growth and expansion, and student scholarships came into play. So at this point, the number of student scholarships that we're able to provide is exponential from what we've been doing before. And I'm finishing up my stint on the OSU Foundation, having served for 12 years. But at each one of our meetings, I report on activities that have gone on from the OSU board itself. And so there's a great deal of support for the kinds of things that not only we are doing, but each one of the universities are doing, because we have that closer look and we can be more accountable. So can I draw a specific line from A to B? I'm not sure, but a lot of good things have happened.
I'll add that following the establishment of the independent boards, we established a new capital campaign goal, or funding campaign goal, of raising $2 billion over a period of years. At this point, we are almost halfway there, and I think are encouraged by the progress that we're making. In the middle of all of this, we ended up going through a transition in the presidency, and the president's relationship with donors is a big factor in achieving that goal. And I think we're very encouraged that as we look forward, we're going to do our very best to achieve that goal, and that will serve to greatly enhance some of the academic programs, accessibility through tuition programs at the university. So I think we are very encouraged.
From the regionals viewpoint, we don't have the critical mass that these big folks have. And so, you know, when they're talking in billions of dollars, we might be talking in thousands of dollars. We have foundations. We're raising those things. And that will be part of our function to do that. But I would hope that you would not think that that we're going to solve the financial problem, because we're still going to be looking at the legislature. I mean, it's, you know, is this public good? What is the public good here? This goes back to one of these strategies. What is the public good here? Do you feel like public money should be spent for education? I mean, that's the question, really, to you folks. And the truths, if we're going to get to the 40-40-20, you need the truths involved, even though we're smaller. We serve the rural areas, more poverty areas, that type of thing. You understand all that, but and we will get to the fundraising, but that's not our sole governance outlook, at least from the true presidents that I've talked to. So.
Representative Wisnett, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, with a lot of time, and I won't ask questions. I'll first thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for your service on the boards. It's very important to have qualified, highly qualified, and interested people like you on the boards. As a member of this assembly for some time, and as a member who voted to establish the governances like they are, and a lot of time, about 2.5 sessions were spent on that. We wish you success, because I voted yes. So, and we all know there have been issues, and with individual schools and finances and things like that. I won't ask questions, but I will be contacting your staffs to look at what kind of transparency reporting you do provide to the public. And also asking your staff, and I don't know that you get into this, but I understand there's a significant amount of your student body that gets paid minimum wage, and what your position will be on any minimum wage action that this body takes. Thank you very much for your service.
Thank you. Representative McKinnon, please.
Thank you, Chair Reed. And I too, want to thank you for your service. I know how difficult these jobs are, and we greatly appreciate the work that you do on our behalf and on your students' behalfs. Senator Nelson, I want to touch on something that you brought up that I've had concern about for quite some time, and it has to do with the public skepticism about the value of higher education. And I think the question I'd like to pose is, how do you view that with your institution in relationship to the other TRUs? How does that fit in statewide with your larger sister schools? Is this an across-the-board problem still? And how does the new governance structure that we have created hopefully begin to address this issue of the perception of the value of higher education?
Well, I think the last question is, we're going to be involved locally. I mean, we have, on our board of directors, we started in Ontario with two representatives. Baker City, we have two. We've got Haynes, we've got North Powder, we've got LeGrand, we've got Pendleton, we've got the Tribe, we've got Hermiston, Boardman. Our job is going to be storytellers. We're going to go out and say, higher education is valuable. Education is valuable all the way through. And one of the problems we have in Eastern Oregon is that there's like 15% of the adult population has a higher degree. But in, I think in the urban areas, it's more like 30%. Isn't it? I mean, it's, there's a huge difference. But an interesting fact is that we have a higher graduation rate in our high schools.
Yeah.
80% of our kids will graduate out of the high schools. But then we have this disconnect going into the next thing. So we're addressing those problems. Eastern Promise.
Yes.
That's something I did want to bring up here because the funding was cut in that thing in the right minute. We were planning on it. Very successful program for us. May not be successful, the same program may not be successful in Western Oregon. But for us, with our geographical diversity and our ethnic diversity, large Hispanic populations showing up, and I think that's our job. We have to go out and sell that to our people within our region. I think that's going to be the value of these boards. That we're going to go out and say, hey, look, education's valuable. We're going to help you get there.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Representative Rudin, please.
Also, I'd like to thank you for being here as well. It's obvious your dedication to your communities and your schools really comes across. So you appreciate your bringing your message. One of you mentioned the fact that a lot of folks coming into your system require remedial education, which, you know, you'd think you'd want to look at the P-12 system for, you know, how do you fix that? But do you see any role in higher ed for reducing the amount of remedial education required?
Sure. I mean, I connect my work in early childhood is very connected to this issue because it has a lot to do with teacher preparation and workforce training and how we make sure that the system works not just from a programmatic standpoint, but really supporting the pipeline of educators and what those competencies are across the board. And so I think when we have that aligned and integrated funding, that's one foundational piece. But the whole early childhood field needs a huge infusion and support look at how the professional development piece connects to K-12 and higher ed. And I think once we start thinking about quality teaching and building that so that teachers can sort of help their students move to the next place and know how their students did and have that feedback loop. So I think we still have a ways to go to make sure that the information goes bidirectionally so that we know that we're being effective in moving students through the system. And I think obviously in higher ed, that close connection between community colleges and the four-year institutions, there's a lot of good and important work happening there. A huge percentage of the PSU students are transfer students. But I still think that the remedial issues are very germane. And as we know, that is really, many of those issues go to the first 5 years of life. And so we've got to do all we can to think about supporting parents and children to get kids started early. And then I think higher ed has a really exciting opportunity to play in working with the other parts of the education system to reimagine what a teacher needs to know in a much more diverse economy and world stage than we're all on now than the design of programs generations ago.
Nice.
I would like to make a comment. Everything you said is absolutely true, but we can't take those kids back to the first 5 years. We get them when we get them, where we get them, how we get them. And it's very important for us to, instead of lamenting the need for remediation, is to provide whatever is needed for those kids, young adults in order for them to have a successful experience. And I, there are, I could probably name a dozen people who, if you predicted their success in life, would never have been predicted in the positive column. My husband didn't learn to read until a grade five. Ken Austin didn't, he couldn't hold a job for 5 years until he found the right job. There are so many things that play into this. So yes, there are many issues that we have to look at in terms of the entire system, but at the university level, we can't fix those things, but we can do something about the kids who come to us or the young adults who come to us as they come, and we're working on that.
Yeah, Eastern has just received a grant, federal grant. It's called TRIO. I really believe that's the right word, TRIO grant, and basically helping underserved students coming in, you know, that, that aren't prepared. And so we're working very hard on doing that. It's one of, that's one of our big issues that we have. And as we say, we want you to be successful, too. That's why we're saying we have to look at education as the whole spectrum, from pre-K all the way through. So
congratulations.
It's going to take time. And it's hard for hard for the legislature because you work in two-year increments a lot of the times. And so, you know, what's it going to be like in 20 years? But the decisions you're making now will make a difference.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just have a comment. I really appreciate this last discussion. I think that it really reflects, I think, the partnership that was intended between the legislature and the governing boards. I think that as an educator, as a professor, I mean, a principle I always had to keep in mind was really looking at where the student was developmentally. And I think that's what you're reflecting is, just as we're struggling to reinvest in education after 30 years of disinvestment, I think the same thing, you know, we're trying to look at where we're at, and I think you're doing the same thing. So thank you very much for that.
I have what I hope are two quick questions that follow up on comments and questions that have already been asked, one a little more practical and one a little more philosophical. On the practical side, Ms. Reeser, I was glad to hear your description of the changes you've made in process as a result of the experience on tuition and so on. That's really consistent with some of the things that we heard from students and faculty about. My description of their statement was sort of easy, practical things that could be changed that would make everything go smoother. Are there other examples that we should know about beyond the one that you already mentioned that you've changed to make the process go smoother and help facilitate better communication, those sorts of things?
The issue that came up at PSU was the timing of quarterly board meetings, and we're sort of managing making sure you're passing budget and getting all that calendar versus the student calendar of finals and vacations. And so we've been working to get input. We just put out a poll or a survey. The real sticky one is the holidays, the December period, and there's no good time, but we're essentially just going through an input process and adjusting the calendar accordingly. But I think we've had to fine-tune that.
Likewise, at Oregon, we have adjusted the calendar slightly, especially on the tuition recommendation, and enhanced or increased the number of opportunities to provide input. We're also looking at the calendar for board meetings to ensure that as much as possible, board meetings are at times when students are on campus so they can provide input. One challenge is the requirement to have a board meeting each quarter, which given the summer, you know, creates a challenge. But I understand there are discussions underway about possibly proposing a change to that.
We have at Eastern, we have a non-traditional president. Not come from academia. He came from the timber industry. But he's changing a lot of process. He's basically changing the culture, starting from his own staff and moving forward. And so it's interesting to see the direction he's going. And the faculty is doing very well. I mean, they were a little bit reluctant at first to say, you know, how's this thing going to work out? But he's doing the things he needs to do, and we're continually changing our processes, meetings, and he recently had a three-day workshop for his staff and other members of the campus on it's a program called Vital Smarts. It's how to make an organization run more efficiently. It's really quite interesting. So it's something maybe the legislature hadn't had. I didn't say that.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
You're entitled, Senator.
Yeah, indeed, you are. Well, I think it's safe for me to say on behalf of the committee that was really interesting testimony from them, and I think we're interested in those kind of continual evolutions in processes to make for smoother results. The more philosophical question, and this I think really speaks to what you said, Senator Nelson, as paraphrased by Representative Johnson, about keep the money coming and leave us alone. It strikes me that what we were really trying to do in this vision was hit the right balance between economies of scale across a system and the autonomy for local boards and local institutions, in recognizing that we're somewhat constrained for time. Do you think we're close to that right balance, or are there changes that we should be, and maybe a way to ask this question as a sort of concluding one is, what do we need to be paying attention to, since we don't get to interact with you on a daily basis through our session and beyond? What are the kind of indicators of whether we're hitting that right balance?
Well, since I seem to have brought that up, and I don't mean to say that and stay out of it, because this is shared governance. I mean, we have to come to you and our relationship. You are our biggest donor. I mean, we're the practical part of that. How am I going to say this exactly? We as Board of Trustees need to stay at a higher level, and I think you as the legislature need to stay at a higher level even more, and let the university presidents and their provosts and their faculty and those folks run the organization. It's going to be a fine line how we're going to balance that. But example, we had a couple of weeks ago, we had we could apply for a request from HEC for something as $210,000. One of the requirements from HEC was this has to be board approved. Well, I don't think the board needs to be down improving that $210,000 grant. That's something the president, he ought to be telling us about it, tell us what's going on. But I would like you guys to think really much more strategically. You know, is education important? You know, you have to send more money out to help us do it, pre-K all the way through. What are the strategic things that you can do rather than get in and say, okay, University of Oregon, you have to run a certain way, or Oregon State or Eastern, you have to run a certain way. We're all different, all geographically different, size different. We have different finances. Treat us, I guess getting away from the culture of the old university system. I think maybe philosophically that's the biggest thing. Because I sort of see with HEC, they've got a board of about 120, or a staff of about 120 people. They got to keep those people busy somewhere or another. We don't have any staff at all as our Board of Trustees yet. I mean, we're talking about that. Do we need we're using the university president's office staff, which, is that a conflict of interest? There's times we're going to disagree with the president. I know we are. So how do we come about? So those are things that I think that we need to continue to talk with you folks with, so we can make this thing is working in my view. This, I mean, good job.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We will obviously continue to watch and be eager to hear from you when you think we need to. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can toss them.
I'll read them.
We're going to move now to a discussion of building on our work on the Oregon Promise and community colleges. Representative Johnson, do you want to go around or do you want to stay up here?
I'll go down there and I'll have a couple of
Please
my,
bring whomever you'd like with you.
That's all right.
Yeah, please. I assume you're going to kick us off, Representative Johnson, and then I'll let you introduce your colleagues as well. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mark Johnson. I am the State Representative for House District 52. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come before you today and talk about legislative concept number 126. Feels funny to talk about LCs, doesn't it? Soon to be HB, whatever, something. Seated with me are a couple of individuals that have come from a long distance today. Betsy Crone has come from Texas. She is the AVID director for higher education. You're going to hear a lot more about the AVID program. And next to her is Christy Plinsky from Gresham, from Mount Hood Community College. So you're going to hear some great testimony from them. And one individual who's not with us today, who would be here had he not had a private sector commitment, is Senator Mark Haas, who is also supportive of what we're doing here today. And I think you'll find a letter of support from him on OLIS about what we're going to be talking about. Just to refresh your memories, committee, in the 2015 session, this committee and this legislative body passed Senate Bill 81, which has become known as the Oregon Promise. And as I'm sure you'll recall, the Oregon Promise calls for providing tuition waivers to community college for high school graduates who meet residency and academic requirements and also make adequate progress as post-secondary students. You'll also recall that this body generously allocated $10 million for the tuition waivers for these students who meet the requirements and also first complete the FAFSA form so that they can receive whatever federal and state financial aid that they may be eligible for, so that the state of Oregon then is actually paying the last dollar for that community college or for the career school that also qualifies. Passing the Oregon Promise was an incredibly significant step for this state, and it literally has put us on the map. As you'll recall, Oregon now has joined Tennessee as one of just two states nationally that have in place tuition waivers for qualifying students. And in doing so, we have garnered a great deal of attention nationally for our efforts. Over the past both Senator Haas and I have been invited to attend and have participated in White House panels talking about the Oregon Promise and about college affordability. And the country is really, really interested in finding out how we did this, first of all, and is this going to be a successful program? And what I've told the attendees at these events is that although passing the Oregon Promise was a challenge legislatively, because remember, we had to get both the colleges had to be supportive, we had to get the student groups to be supportive, we had to secure the funding necessary to make this thing work, and then we had to get the votes out of both the House and Senate to get this thing across the finish line. That was a daunting task, but the real challenge, and this is what I really want to focus on today and what this legislative concept is about, the real challenge before us is to make sure that these Oregon Promise students who enter the college system this next fall will become, in fact, successful students. That they will not just enroll, but that these students will persist as students and they will complete their associate's degree or their career certificate within a reasonable time frame. I say that it will be a challenge for our Oregon Promise students to be successful simply because of factors that are in place that we have heard about, again, at this committee level, that can make that a daunting prospect. And I'll just refer back to the audit that came out last spring by the Secretary of State, and I pulled a few quotes from that, just, again, not to pile on or not to embellish needlessly the situation that we currently have at our colleges, but just to point out that in the Secretary of State's report, they said that 24% of our enrolled community college students are actually completing within 7 years. We can do better. Oregon, according to a 2010 graduation rate out of the Chronicle of Higher Education, we rank 41st out of 50. Not the last, but certainly not the best. But importantly, a couple other factors that the report pointed out, that most colleges have limited capacity and the expertise to analyze data for decision-making and continuous improvement. And finally, community colleges have been proactive in supporting their students. They're making good faith efforts, but they currently lack the resources and capacity to scale student success initiatives and to meet the needs of all students. And again, I would, again, not point the finger of blame at the colleges, because part of that obviously comes from us. We haven't funded higher ed as we should, and we all agree. And I think we turned the corner that last session to make a good faith effort in an entirely different direction. But there's better work that we can do. And again, these community colleges, these Oregon Promise students are going to be arriving on the doorsteps in September.
we all can agree that we need to do a better job of not just enrolling students, but providing them with the support services that they need to help reach their potential and to compete as students so that they can move on to be successful members of our society. In the last session, we also passed Senate Bill 418. You'll recall that when we came through the committee, we said Senate Bill 81 is the great policy. Senate Bill 418 can actually be a real good tool to help successful implementation. And in Senate Bill 418, there's approximately $6.8 million that's set aside for various student support that could go from dual accreditation to accelerated learning, but also what can we do to help provide better tools at our colleges. All 17 community colleges are working hard to do all that they can to help their students be successful, but what they really lack are targeted resources. So what if we made available to all of our colleges a data-driven, outcomes-based student support program that is achieving some remarkable accomplishments in other states and in certain settings right here in Oregon as well? What if this state was to use some of that $6.8 million that's sitting there in Senate Bill 418 and focused it on a program like AVID? AVID stands for Advancement Via Individual Determination. And just a little background, some of you may be aware of this, Chair Reed. I know that Beaverton is a school district that has a really robust AVID program, but AVID is currently being used in hundreds of schools across our state within school districts, both junior highs, middle schools, high schools. Very intentional program to try to engage students that show great academic potential, but just have roadblocks perhaps in front of them. Could be ethnic relationships, could be financial, could be just being first in their family to ever even consider going beyond a K-12 education. AVID is a program that is having excellent results. And in the packet you have on the table in front of you, I think you'll see some data there that shows that AVID at the high school level is in fact eradicating the achievement gap. AVID students are entering college and qualifying for college at a rate equal to our Anglo population, and it's a remarkable transformation. But AVID also has a higher ed component, and that's why I brought in these fine folks next to us here. I'm going to let Betty Crone from Texas talk about AVID for higher education and let you understand more about what's going on nationally and to see what we might be able to do here locally in Oregon.
And Dr. Crone, not to take you off your plan, but and maybe I'm the only one who has this question, but in addition to sort of the components, maybe you could give us a brief kind of history or how the structure works as individual districts and institutions mm-hmm. decide to participate with that. That'd be helpful, at least for me.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Just one
apologize. I don't understand, Mark. Are we going to talk more about the bill and everything? We're just going to talk about this because mm-hmm. I wanted to ask how we're doing as far as mentors, because I think that's the big, that was my big concern. I think other members too concerned about our program of the Oregon Promise. And isn't some of that money dedicated for that?
I think that's what he's.
Chair Reed and Representative Wisnett, at this point there isn't the HEC has completed a recommendation process for how the resources in Senate Bill 418 should be expended. There are recommendations in there for doing something like what you're talking about, but as you'll recall, Tennessee had a program of really robust volunteer mentors. We haven't gone down that pathway in Oregon. We're trying to get in place actual programs at the college that can employ and access volunteer mentors, perhaps, or more likely staff, faculty, who have the skills necessary to be able to interact with those students where they're at. So we're going in a little bit different direction here in Oregon than Tennessee has with their model. But I think you'll hear more about that.
Thank you. I apologize. You bet.
And just to summarize, it sounds like essentially what we're saying is that your bill, and hopefully we'll get back to that, is a mechanism to address this question of how to support students. So we'll get back to that.
Exactly.
Come on, please.
Chair Reed and representatives, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you this morning. I'm Betty Crone, Director of AVID for Higher Education, and it's my great privilege to introduce you to the AVID for Higher Ed program and how it can make a difference in the academic success of students. As AVID does stand for Advancement Via Individual Determination. And we are already in about 169 of the Oregon sites. And in the folder that was provided to you, there was a handout that gave you the quick facts regarding that. And AVID is a nonprofit. We are dedicated to closing the achievement gap, whether it be at the K-12 level or the higher ed level. And we have a proven track record of 35 years that has been researched by third-party researchers. AVID's not just another program. It really is a philosophy. We believe that if you hold students accountable and you provide them the academic and social support that they need, that they will rise to that challenge. And although the higher ed program can support every single student on a college campus, we really want to focus on those first generation, minorities, low socioeconomic students, and to really help them to persist until they are ready for completion. We develop skills and behaviors for academic success, and we provide a very intensive, holistic, comprehensive support that helps a student all the way through their college experience. The key components that we actually bring to the campus are support for the AVID seminar. That's the first year experience course. We also have a lot of support for what we call Socratic tutoring. It's not your normal reteach tutoring, but we really want to involve students in the inquiry process. We bring faculty development. In fact, AVID is known for their faculty development. We also address peer mentoring, and Chair Reed, Representative Wisnett, that peer mentoring is also shared with faculty who are mentors as well, so that might address that. Mm-hmm. We also bring effective advising services to the campus, as well as support for other co-curricular services. Research tells us that when you use these components in concert, that's when you get students to be more successful. And if you have that handout on the components, it gives you a little bit more information there. AVID's not a cookie-cutter approach, though, to improving student success, but rather a very flexible set of tools that can be incorporated into each college's individual structures. We support a campus team that is composed of administration, faculty, academic, and student affairs. And we help that team to really create a plan that's a vision for actually addressing what that college chooses to actually focus on. And the college may choose to focus on a very particular set of students, such as the Oregon Promise students, or students who we sometimes describe as the murky middle. And regardless of where college begins, though, it is the long-term goal to have all students on that campus committed, successful, and the personnel there committed to that success. We're very, very flexible. We want the college to guide the work and set those priorities, make the decisions, and we're there to support through the professional learning, team facilitations, and ongoing coaching and support. We want to offer a variety of options that exist or create new ones. If the college says we really need support in a certain area, then we want to rise to that occasion and bring that support to the campus. As I said earlier, we're known for our in-depth on-site professional learning workshops. We model how to use these skills and how faculty can infuse them into courses and create a common language for both faculty and students. And it's that common language that really provides that holistic approach that increases institutional effectiveness. Some examples. The higher ed piece is relatively new to the AVID K-12 system. And we actually started about 6 years ago, and we're seeing results that are really outstanding. Odessa College in Texas started with us in 2011. They're both an AVID campus and an Achieving the Dream campus. And they're a community college with minority first-generation students primarily. Mm-hmm. And in a December article about their success, researcher and educator Brad Phillips stated that over the past 4 years, Odessa has almost closed all gaps between the underrepresented and the underserved students when it comes to retention and course completion. He stated that Hispanic males improved at an all-time high of 94% retention rate and almost 74% success rate. He stated, "It's remarkable for any college, but to consider that 5 years ago, Odessa College was among three colleges in Texas that the Texas legislature targeted for defunding." Don Wood, the vice president there for institutional effectiveness, he said, and he sent this to me in an email just this last week, says, "For the first time in the history of our college, we are being recognized on a national level. And education experts such as Brad Phillips are highlighting our achievements. I not only understand but also deeply appreciate that these achievements are also in part testimony that Avid's partnership with Odessa College is proving to be successful at the most fundamental level of post-secondary education, that of student retention and student success." Amarillo College is another one that's been with us since 2011. They're also another Achieving the Dream College. And over the past 4 years, they have actually seen a 25% plus increase in the student pass rates and a yearly 5% plus increase in student retention. President Laurie Hart said that Achieving the Dream helped Amarillo to use data to identify what needed to be done, but Avid brought in the how do you do it, and so we were there to support them. Nash Community College in Rocky Mount, North Carolina is another one that started with us in 2012, and their leadership acknowledged the value of the pedagogically sound instructional strategies that we bring to the campus and how they correspond with the value to student success. Mike Lantham, their Dean of Instruction and Chief Program Officer, reported increases of retention rates 4% the initial semester, and then each semester thereafter has been an increase of at least 5%. He says that the campus leadership believes that retention rates have increased due to the effective student instruction utilizing Avid strategies. They've also had a drop in new enrollment, but their overall campus enrollment has actually increased 3%. And that's like you've increased 3%, but you dropped new enrollments 11%. How does that work? It means they're retaining their students. They're being successful. We believe the money is very well spent. We're quite economical when we bring your program to the campus because we work in concert with the people on the campus, with the leadership. And we bring it to each campus about $30,000 a year. And we can support as many students as you wish, from a very select low-performing group to the whole campus. To give you an example, I understand that the 7,000 Oregon Promise students are supposed to hit the doors in the fall. And if we took an average of 400 on each of the 17 community college campuses that you have, that would be less than $100 per student. But if we, at the same time, if we look at Columbia Gorge Community College's enrollment, they have an enrollment of about 4,600 students, I believe, and they could serve every single student on their campus for as little as $7 a student. So for that reason, if you're wanting a little bit more details, there is another handout in there with the proposal for those details. Our goal is to build capacity, and that's what we really want to happen on those campuses. And when we build capacity so the faculty and staff of that campus can continue it, own the culture, and own that Avid philosophy, we want to be those partners that really help that to happen. In closing, I wanted to say that Oregon could be not just a model for opening access to colleges, but also a model for student success. And we want to we commend you for passing the Oregon Promise last year. You told the nation you're really, really serious about creating opportunities for your Oregon students. And we know you have challenges, as every community across the nation is faced with these exact same challenges. But we firmly believe that Avid can do for you and your institutions what it has done at Amarillo, at Odessa, at Rocky Mount, and many other institutions that work with us. We are aligned with your community college strategic plan. We are adaptable to address student success needs. Mm-hmm. And we support the creation of a campus-wide vision for that student success, and that's what really makes the difference. Oregon can be a state model across the nation, and Avid for Higher Education, we're ready and willing to help you be that and make that proclamation to the nation that you can help students be successful.
Thank you, Dr. Crone. Appreciate it. Ms. Plinsky, are you up next? Very good. You're getting the thumbs up from Representative Johnson.
Okay. Chair Reed, representatives, it is my great pleasure to be here before you today and to talk to you a little bit about why Mount Hood Community College chose AVID. My name is Christy Plinsky. I am currently Vice President of Instruction at Mount Hood Community College, and I actually bring, I'm not going to tell you how many decades, you can probably guess from the shade of my hair, but many, many decades of experience in education from K-12 through community college, through post-secondary teaching in the university, counselor, high school principal, and now vice president at a community college. So I have sort of a unique lens in the fact that I understand what happens and the change in student capacity to learn and the student ability and efficacy. So what we did many years ago, we all know that the completion rate for students in all post-secondary is rising. Or not the completion rate, the need for post-secondary is really rising. The completion rate is actually staying pretty stagnant. We have somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% completion rate of all students who enter post-secondary who actually complete. What we also know is that in 2018, more than two-thirds of all jobs in our economy will require some level of post-secondary training. Now, that's not necessarily transfer degrees. That's certificates, workforce training, stackable credentials, transfer degrees, ongoing graduate degrees, etc. But two-thirds of all jobs in 2018 will require some level of post-secondary. So we also talked earlier, and I heard questions in the first presentation about remedial education and students are not college ready when they get there. My belief, and it's taken from a statement that Vincent Tinto made many, many years ago, and it is that access without support is not opportunity for students. And for me, the access, the open access of community colleges is there. It's been the mission of community colleges for 50-some years. The support part of it is shifting. We need sort of a seismic shift in the culture of community colleges in all post-secondary institutions to move from a delivery of instruction model to a facilitating learning model, and that's a very, very different pedagogical model. We also know that to do that takes a pretty big cultural shift, and Terry O'Banion had once said that changing the culture of an institute of higher education is a little bit like moving a cemetery. You don't get much help from the residents. So what we know is that in order to get more help from the residents, our faculty, our staff, our students, our community members, we have to help inform them on best practices to make a difference in the lives of students. And that takes time. It takes time to really change. So in 2011, Mount Hood, along with all other colleges in the country, and particularly in Oregon, were looking at initiatives that could help us look at this seismic shift that was necessary. We looked at Achieving the Dream, and we knew that it was critical in terms of evidence-based practices. We did a comparison between Achieving the Dream and AVID, largely probably because as a K-12 educator, I had a pretty significant knowledge of AVID, and it frankly is my dissertation work as well. So when we looked at the two initiatives and many, many other initiatives through the League of Innovation, American Association of Community Colleges, et cetera, what we found as the difference between Achieving the Dream and others and AVID was the professional development, the ongoing training of faculty and staff about how to better support, provide that support along with the access so that all students have the opportunity for a successful community college career. So we chose on our own, only community college in Oregon and only one of two in Washington and Oregon, we chose to go with AVID. And we looked at it, we appreciated the flexibility that AVID provides in higher ed, and we chose to go with students where the greatest need was in the Gresham area, East County. And we know that students in East County, we have a lot of demographic changes. We have a lot of first-generation college goers. We have a lot of individuals who live in poverty. Many of our K-12 districts have upwards of 70% of students that receive free and reduced lunch. Huge poverty issues in our area. We also, therefore, have a rather growing need for students coming in with remedial education needs. So we chose, again, kind of different, we chose to focus our AVID strategies on students needing developmental education, because when they enter developmental education, they oftentimes will get into this rigid sequence. Sometimes it will take students 6 terms to get through the developmental ed sequence to get into credited classes. They're paying tuition, and they're stuck, and it becomes not an on-ramp to credited classes, which it's intended to be, but rather a dead end. And we wanted to change that because we have a lot of students. We believe everyone has the capacity to learn. We just need to increase the supports to do that. So we started with developmental ed. We had a lot of faculty who were very interested and passionate about making a difference in the lives of students. We did professional development across campus, and yes, we had some pushback from faculty, but we also had great attendance. We've trained over 50% of our staff and our faculty in AVID WICR strategies and high engagement instructional practices. We've started AVID, we opened an AVID center, which was a converted classroom. We hired an AVID coordinator who is with us, Lauren Smith, and she has done a phenomenal job of taking the passion of educators in supporting students and bringing it to the ground level and infusing that in others who join. We have we've started what we call learning communities. It's cohorts of learning that takes the AVID first year experience course and pairs it with a Reading 90, Writing 90 course, developmental ed, reading and writing, to make sure that they get that fundamental impetus to make a difference. And we've seen in the first couple of years, and I'm not exaggerating, we've seen like 84% increase in persistence and retention. That's huge. That's not modest. So we believe that makes a difference. And not only do we have the learning communities, we've started what we call the Summer Bridge Program, so that students coming into the college, first time, first generation, have that access to a community and a staff and a center that supports them, advising, financial aid, course selection, support strategies within the classroom, tutoring. And we've had somewhere in the neighborhood, and I'm going to try to find this number, 18,500 students, hours of support, not 18,000 students, 18,500 hours of support offered to Mount Hood Community College students in the AVID Center. Students flock to the AVID Center because it's a warm, friendly, supportive place. So if I'm sitting in your chair, my question is going to be, well, tell me real stories. You know, all this data is great, and that's good to hear, but tell me real stories of the changes that it's made in the lives of students. And we have that. About a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, we had 3 students who attended the Board of Education at Mount Hood. 3 students who were first generation, 1 just out of prison, an African-American woman who was a single parent and struggling to try to figure out how to do childcare, how to get a career on ground, how to get through the sequence. And we had another student who was also a student in the developmental ed sequence. These students told stories that were powerful and passionate, brought many of the board members to tears, because what it did for these students was change their life. It changed their sense of ability, their sense of capability, and their sense of social and cultural capital. And we've seen a tremendous difference, and it is beginning to get the residents to help us move the cemetery. We believe that it's important, an important strategy. We believe that supporting the Oregon Promise students is a way that we can really make a difference. We can stand out among all states in our nation and show them that providing support along with access provides all students with opportunity, and we think that that is Oregon's promise, not just financial, but in terms of support for students.
That's great testimony. Thank you. I think I'd like to take the initiative of suggesting maybe we can hear about the mechanics of the bill and then ask questions about the program and the whole sort of topic. So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. Yes, on your in front of you, there should be a one-page talented staff put together. I think it summed up the what we're trying to accomplish in the first paragraph here is basically LC 126 would implement AVID for higher education or, and that's a, it's a key or, comparable evidence-based student support programs as approved by the HEC and community college campuses across Oregon to ensure the successful implementation of the Oregon Promise. That's really, in a nutshell, what we're hoping for. Recognizing that some colleges do, in fact, have in place, this is what I'm referring to here.
Thank you. Yep.
Some colleges have in place programs that they're very, they're excited about. I know Lynn Benton, or pardon me, Chemeket, I believe, is received a federal grant that called the, I think, something about path guided pathways. I believe.
All of us are doing that.
All of you are doing it. Okay, there you go. They're very excited about that. I think it's getting some good outcomes. I think that they're, you know, have a program in place that I think has promise. And if, in fact, a college would have in place a program that has similar characteristics to what we see in AVID, that's perfectly fine. We just want to make sure that there is a predictable student-centered platform in place to provide the kind of supports, not just for Oregon Promise students. Oregon Promise is the catalyst, I think, that gets us to take this action. But I think, as you can hear from the testimony we've heard, I think there's going to be collateral benefit for all students, all community college students, whether they're freshly out of high school or returning, you know, career folks as well. So that's it in a nutshell. And the bill itself, I think, again, this may be on your up front of you in the packet, but if you flip to, it'd be the second, I guess, the third page of the bill. Simply reallocate $2 million to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for distribution to an Oregon Community College for the purposes of increasing student persistence and completion through a series of intentional, strategic interventions that strengthen and enhance new and existing curricular and co-curricular activities on campus. And then there's some bullet points down here that talk about what the funding should be utilized for. So in a nutshell, and well, let me just point out one other plan here. This document here that Betty referenced. This document details how a four-year plan can be built out at our community colleges, and it details what the costs are per year and the resources that are available to us through this investment. And if you add up the numbers at the bottom of the page, it's less than $2 million. It's about $1.8 million, I believe. That's a four-year build-out. Most of the costs are in the first year. There's maintenance costs as you go forth and so forth. I'll let you look at that. But this is a very concrete plan. So my point is there's $6.8 million that are sitting there in that bucket, if you will, called Senate Bill 418. What we're proposing in this LC is simply to target, strategically target $2 million of that into a effort that I think will be the key ingredient to ensuring that our Oregon Promise students are successful, but also that we can, through that, build the culture at each campus to where we've got faculty, administration, other support people engaged in a very intentional effort that, as you can hear from wherever it's been tried, it seems, there has been tremendous return on investment. So that, in a nutshell, is what we're proposing, Mr. Chair. So
thank you.
I think we all would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I think we will have some. Thank you.
We're going to have community college.
Are we going to play a student? It's ready to go.
Okay.
You have a video?
Do you want to hear a student?
Sure. Let's hear a student, and we'll have some questions. And while that's getting set, I know Representative Wisnett is wondering about whether we're going to hear from some other folks.
Okay.
And we do have Andrea Henderson here as well, so we'll
maybe
have
maybe she could testify moment. And be up there when we're talking
sure,
about it.
Sure, that's fine. Yeah. Do you want to pull up another chair in the meantime, and we'll hear the video and then hear from you?
Because I think we're
connected.
We need to know what the community college is, in order to know what we're going to be paying, have to pay overtime for teachers and stuff.
All good questions.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Yanelli. I'm 18. I'm a single mother. I just came like fresh out of high school, so I graduated 2015. So it was just kind of hard, you know. Struggling, like, my school, and baby and everything, but good think I graduated on time. I believe that.
Yeah, I think we're probably not going to be able to hear her. I can tell you some statements, not by her, but by others, just really quickly, that'll give you a framework, and then we can move on.
Yeah.
One student had said, what I am most proud of is that I've learned so much about myself that I've never realized or even thought that I had in me. When I use the tools and skills I've learned, I know I'm going to be successful in anything I set my mind to. Anything is possible in life. And another student just said, I love that I was surrounded by people who care about my education. I am not great at socializing on a level that allows meaningful connections and bonds, and I feel much more comfortable asking questions about anything. And she was very appreciative of the support and the cultural kind of supports that she received in the end.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Henderson.
Yes.
And now Representative Wisden had to run away after he specifically wanted to hear from you, so we'll have to recreate your testimony when he comes back.
Thank
Please.
You. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And really happy to be here today to talk about how do we support our students. We've had some great conversations since the last legislative session ended to talk about the Oregon Promise students and how do we take this amazing capacity to bring students in. And how do we help them succeed? And to have this conversation about not just the access of getting students in the door, but how do we make sure that those students succeed and complete is exactly the right conversation that we want to be having. As was mentioned before, we're really going through a sea change in community colleges from a culture of access only. If we get students in the door, they have the freedom to fail. Used to be the philosophy in community colleges. And that's not good enough for our students because, as you can see from our data, we only have a little over 50% of our students walk in the door that walk out with either transferring to a university or completing a certificate or degree. And frankly, that's not good enough for our students. And so across the state, our colleges have been intentionally talking about student success and completion efforts. And how do we change that culture to be very intentional about using the data to show what makes a difference for students? And then how do we implement that? And so to be here today to talk about how do we take this with our Oregon Promise students and ensure that the money that the state's investing to pay for them to come to community colleges is also helping them to succeed is really critical. As we look specifically at programs like AVID, there's clear data out there that shows that it makes a difference. One of the key components of AVID is that first-year experience for community college students. So when they come in the door, taking a class that helps them to succeed as students, to understand how to navigate the college system, how to manage their time, how to really get that sense as Dr. Polinsky talked about, that they have that capacity and that ability to succeed. Some of the studies show that students that come in the door and take a first-year experience class, that their retention goes up by about 10 percentage points. So not 10% above what they were, but an actual 10 percentage points. So if the completion rate was, for example, 72%, it goes up to 82%. Those are real results that make a difference for students. I think what's really key with a program like AVID is that ability to really do that faculty and staff development. I spoke with one of our presidents this morning kind of in preparation. I'm like, okay, I'm on the way to the committee hearing. Tell me a little bit about your first-year experience courses. And they have first-year experience courses at that college. However, it's spotty. If they have a great faculty, those students do better. What AVID would bring to it is that ability to really do that professional development for that faculty that enables them to serve their students even better. And that really is a cultural change that makes a difference for all of the students. I think the other piece in a program like AVID is the flexibility. So as if we are able to do this on behalf of all 17 colleges, there's that ability for each college to take a look at what AVID has to offer and say, well, we're doing these pieces. We can use help here. And it's not a top-down, one-size-fits-all, but really has that flexibility to allow each college to tailor that expertise in a way that fits into what they're already doing. We want to make sure that as we are looking at student success, that we're really building on what we have done and really expanding our capacity so that our students can increase those retention and graduation rates. So with that, I'm just going to close to thank you all for this conversation and to thank you for this continued interest in how we make our students both succeed and complete in community colleges. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I know we have some. Representative Gagos was in the queue initially, please.
Thank you very much for the presentation. You know, I don't question the intent, the mission, the motives of the program. I mean, they all sound great, but let me share with you that in 1975, I was funded with a FIPSE grant, Fund for the Improvement of Postsecondary Education, and the crux of that grant was to address the low graduation needs in Oregon for the Latino community. At that time, in 1975, 40 years ago, it was 50% of our students were not getting out of high school. We've made great progress. Mm-hmm. It's now 55% are graduating. So, you know, 5% difference in 40 years. So, I mean, the need is clearly there, and so I do appreciate the program and the mission. You know, the question that I have, though, is why do we need this? Why are our institutions not doing this already with the monies that we've been giving them? So, I mean, I do think that is a serious question. With regard to the program, you know, for $2 million, if we can get something started like this and change the culture, that's obviously, I think, a good buy. What's interesting to me is we're not just talking about remedial education for students. We're talking about remedial education for faculty. Remedial education for faculty. And my question really then comes down to, what about administration? I mean, I think when we talk about institutional change, we've really got to talk about the decision makers, the administrators. And I would like to see if we do this, that administrators be part of the remedial group.
So it sounds like that might be a question: to what degree are administration included in AVID and other efforts? Is that,
yes,
is that a question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chairman Reed, Representative Gallegos, when we approach a campus, we really want to create a campus team, and that team has to have administration on it. It has to have the leadership committee, because it's not going to go anywhere if it doesn't have that leadership commitment. So, yes, we want them involved in the professional learning, in that orchestration of where do we go, what are the next steps, how are we going to make this happen on our campus. We also want the faculty, because the faculty can either, they can be a roadblock, or they can be the one that pushes us all the way through. Saddleback College in California, the faculty senate chair took this and said this will work, had a hard uphill battle, and in 2 years all of a sudden now it's the faculty that's starting to push this and bringing along the rest of the group. So that campus team really is important. And the reason why it doesn't happen naturally is because you have people on those campuses that are already covered up with jobs,
right,
and they can't orchestrate it. And so when we come in, it's a partnership, and we're going to keep everybody on point. We're going to have that support. We're going to come in and have team meetings with them and look at what are you doing, who's doing what, how is it carrying on? So that's sort of an outside coach. You know, people have to have a life coach. Mm-hmm. We become that educational coach to really say, let's stay on point so that we can move that Hispanic number more than 5% in 40 years.
Can I add one more comment on that? So one of the other things that I think makes a difference with the AVID and why the state of Oregon, the 17 community colleges and across the country have not been able to move that number forward is largely because over the last, you know, 40, 50 years since community colleges have been in operation and post-secondary for years before that, we end up with boutique programs that are addressing specific populations, specific needs of students. So you end up with this pocket of boutique programs across a campus, and you don't have a collective, collaborative process that touches everybody. Similar outreach, similar mindset, similar trainings. What we found at Mount Hood is that we're beginning that process of bringing those boutique programs into one system. And we've had challenges at Mount Hood in many ways. We've had successes. This is one that is really beginning to shift a culture.
Quickly, please.
If I could. So also, the biggest challenge we have is taking things to scale. And this is not an Oregon problem, but this is a national problem with community colleges across the country. We are not helping our students to complete. And so as we look at all of these different pieces, we've really identified in Oregon three key areas that we need to work on. One is that faculty development, which is really key to help the faculty and the administrators build a different culture. It's the guided pathways for our students, and it's the developmental ed reform. And so this is one key piece of our strategies to help move that forward.
I know, Representative McCune, you were in the queue, but I think Representative Wisner's question is particularly relevant based on that comment, so I'll come to you in just a moment.
Andrea, have you talked to community colleges? Have they budgeted this? How are you going to pay the professors, the administrators, extra time? They're going to be paid to attend this class. How does that affect it? I'm a capitalist. I'm for free market. And Representative Gallegos and I think I would have to say that I amen your comments. He and I have been working for a long time and trying that 5% is embarrassing. And we've been trying to work in K-12 to put some attention like this in the K-12 curriculum to look at these students in need. English language learners in poverty, and what you're saying is good as far as helping and the results, but both the chair and I are on Ways and Means. We're going to have some more data as far as what's the bottom line cost. Are you going to take that additional money to get the training out of the existing budget, or how are you going to do that?
So, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Wisnett. I can't answer the question fully because we've not had the conversation yet with all the colleges, but what I can tell you is there will be cost to the colleges to implement it. So the colleges will have to find the resources within their existing budgets to pay for the work that needs to be done. What I will say is as you look at the colleges' budgets with the we're doing student success efforts. Colleges are finding ways to carve out the money. It's difficult given the budget situation. But over the last several years, we are showing increases in our completion rates. So we know that what we're doing is making a difference. An investment in something like this will help us get there faster. It's very targeted. It's on a statewide basis. It's something that our colleges have done in the past that does show a difference. For example, several years ago, 10 of our colleges joined Achieving the Dream, which was the other program that was mentioned that's similar to AVID, but is on a slightly different scale. Those colleges are showing a difference. They were able to pull together some money from our strategic fund to implement it. We need to keep doing this work. It costs money to do it. Any help that we can get from the state, for example, to do some sort of collective contract helps. If we can't get the money from the state, we'll continue to try to carve it out of our budgets. We'll continue to apply for grants. We'll continue to go to foundations. But this work is important, and we'll find a way to do it.
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Quickly, I appreciate the question, Representative. It's a good one. The proposal in front of you, I think, would cover the cost to AVID for implementation. But your question about staff time and so forth is a good one. All we're requesting in this LC is allocation of the $2 million of the $6.8 million that is available via Senate Bill 418. It could be possible for, I'm just talking off the top of my head, for the colleges to put together a request for X amount of additional dollars that could go along with this to pay for some of that professional development time that I think you're concerned about. Secondly, I would mention it too. I think on all this, you'll see a letter of support from Nike. Mm-hmm. Nike has been very, very supportive financially at the K-12 level for implementation of AVID in the 100 and some odd schools that you currently see it happening. They're very supportive of this LC and this initiative, and I think as the state may take a step forward in putting a program like this in place, I think it's entirely possible we'll see some private sector support come in as well as we go forward, because they too have an interest in seeing that the Oregon Promise is successful and that we're improving our job, our workforce requirements and so forth out there as well. So,
Mr. Chair, we need to clarify. Representative, was the money is one time only? It's not a continuation, right? With the money we set there, so we'd have to come up
with... This would pay for a four-year plan, so this would get you a plan of program in place for at least 4 years. Going forth, there's going to be a need of sustainability component as well.
Thanks. Representative McKeown, please.
Thank you, Chair Reed. And I'm not quite sure who to address the question to, so I'll just throw it out and you can figure out how to answer. I ran a mentoring program in high schools for a long time, and I could walk into that high school and I could tell you if the program was going to be successful or not by who was supporting it and who was not. And I'm sure that the culture is the same on community college campuses. And I guess my question is Representative, is it required that all 17 colleges participate? Is this, or can they choose not to under this program that is a negotiation between the state and Avid, I'm guessing? And second of all, is there some way that we can gauge the community college support for this, knowing that if there is resistance, if faculty is not on board, if the administration is not fully engaged, it's going to be difficult to implement a program? So I'm kind of curious about that.
Representative, to answer your first question, it's not the intent to force feed this to anybody. It's an asset that's available with great data, with some great outcomes locally as well as nationally. It would be our hope that there is system-wide going to be something in place that at least replicates what Avid can bring to play. I think we're at that point, I think, as a state, to begin to insist, and I think both Representative Gallegos and Representative Wisnett are kind of saying this, we need to get something in place that works and we can assure that students are receiving the supports that they need when they come ready to be successful students. We need to do a better job. We're at that point, I think, as a state, and I think the Oregon Promise is a catalyst to really push that discussion forward. So, but no, we can't make, I think, a college adopt a specific plan and program and so forth. So it would be my hope that as we see a greater implementation, that just best practices and people saying, gosh, I want to be a part of that too. Community saying, hey, we, you know, Lynn Benton's doing this, why can't Umpqua do that? You know what I mean? That kind of thing.
Right.
So,
follow.
Yeah, please.
Don't misunderstand my enthusiasm for the support that this offers. This is a world I've worked in, and I understand how important it is. I'm just curious, are the college presidents on board? Have we had those conversations? It seems like we're a little, there's maybe a timing issue here. But if you'd like to address that, fine. If not, it's an answer that can go into the ether.
Well, and I'll jump in and just say that they certainly can answer it now if they wish. But the other advantage of having this conversation now is this is sort of a preview. I'll say that I hope that this LC, when it gets a bill number, might come back to the committee and we'll get to have more of that conversation. I'll flag for myself. I'm also interested in how PCC's Future Connect interacts here, too. That's a question for later on as well. But feel free to answer this or say that's for the hearing.
Or more to come when the actual bill rolls out, which that's perfectly fine as well. And I have one more.
Yeah, please. Go ahead.
Could we get an answer to that question,
yes.
if they would offer it?
Sure.
So, Chair Reed, Representative McCown, yes, we are going through a process to have the conversation with our colleges. So I can't tell you today that all 17 presidents have signed on. We are going through that process. And certainly what I can tell you is there's a commitment statewide to student success. This is a great program. So long as colleges can have that space to figure out what works with their institution, my prediction is that they'll be very supportive. But we are having those conversations. We have a student success oversight committee with representation from all colleges that are meeting at the end of this month, along with my board, and we will have those conversations and bring back those answers to you.
Thank you. And I would be remiss if I didn't. Did you have one more?
I was going to add, I'll be presenting this concept to that student oversight committee
great.
The last week of the month as well.
Thank you. Colleagues, I would like to let you all know that you can attribute my service here to a 20-minute conversation I had with Ms. Plinsky in 1989. She is solely responsible for my legislative service.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Exactly right.
Ms. Plinsky was on the school board in Coos Bay and was leaving the community. She called me out of the blue, a cold call, asked to come up and have coffee. She came up and sat in my patio and had a cup of coffee with me and said, I think you should throw your hat in. I'm leaving the school board and we'll need to appoint a replacement. And I thought she was out of her mind. I had first and second grade children at the time. And because of her thoughtful nudging, I actually threw my hat in the ring, was appointed to the school board, which has parlayed itself truly into my public service career. Christy, I haven't seen you in decades.
I know.
Thank you very much for your thoughtful coffee.
You bet.
What a nice piece of evidence about your vision. So. Yeah. Thank you.
Actually, what this attributes it to is exactly what we're talking about with student success. It's the right person at the right time, cracking a door, making a comment that changes a person's life. Mm-hmm. And Christy was that person for me.
Right. Thank you. That's very nice. Very kind. Thank you. And a nice way to conclude what I hope is the preview of this bill coming back to us. So thank you very much for your testimony and for being here. That's really cool. That takes us to the Oregon Innovation Plan, which is in front of us, and three people who are central to its development are with us. Aaron Flynn, Chair of Oregon Inc. Kanth Kapal for the Entrepreneur in Residence, and recently, come on up, you three, please. I'm just filling a little time introducing you while you come forward, and that's it. Mr. Kapalper is in addition to being the Entrepreneur in Residence at BIZO, was just announced yesterday as a nominee to the Business Development Commission, and Heather Stafford from BIZO as well. So this is the culmination, or at least the most recent development in the element of the bill that we passed that required the development of this plan, and we're eager to hear about it.
So, Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Heather Stafford, Assistant Director of Innovation Entrepreneurship with Business Oregon, and really just a request, actually, on process and time. I thought we were done at 10, and so
we've got a bit longer. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're fine.
I would also respectfully request from the committee that we perhaps reschedule a longer conversation, as this is quite a large download of information. And so I had intended to go through that, but it will take, I think it justifies a good hour, perhaps during short session or whatever.
That'd be fine, too. If you want to give us an orientation to it, this might work well as a two-parter. You can kind of preview it for us. And I hadn't seen it yet either, so being able to actually digest it and come back with more substantive conversation and discussion would be good. So maybe you can walk us through it, and then we can do that when we're all together in February,
sure.
too. Great.
Yeah, that'd be great. That gives you a chance. And we encourage you to read through in detail, and we took a different tactic here with this innovation plan than have ever done before, because it's the 10-year decade mark for Oregon Innovation Council. And I will actually just speed through some of these slides, but I'll let Aaron and Kant introduce themselves and reflect on kind of how we came to this process.
Great. Hello, Chair Reed and committee members. My name is Aaron Flynn, and I am the new chair of Oregon Inc., and I'm really excited about this new role and this team and launching this plan. Just for a bit of context, when Sean Robbins, the recently departed director of Business Oregon, came to Business Oregon, he created a new strategy for Business Oregon called Grow Our Own, with really an emphasis on growing and retaining our own companies, as opposed to the traditional focus in economic development on recruiting companies to the state. And at the time, Oregon Inc. was the centerpiece of the state's innovation and entrepreneurship efforts. But as Heather said, over the last 10 years, there's really been a remarkable shift, change, growth in the innovation and entrepreneurship ecosystem. And what we recognized and what Sean recognized is that we needed to really elevate innovation and entrepreneurship to a central level within the state's economic development agency. And that we needed to better integrate and weave together a number of disparate programs and components of this emerging innovation and entrepreneurship ecosystem into a coherent strategy and platform. And the result of that is a new division within Oregon Inc. dedicated to innovation and entrepreneurship. So that's very exciting that has been sort of formally institutionalized. Heather was hired as the first director of this component of Business Oregon, and Kanth Gopalpur was recruited to be the first entrepreneur in residence at Business Oregon. He's a successful entrepreneur who has run a company and had an exit or sold recently. So to have that kind of expertise and hands-on experience actually inside the agency, I think, is unique and a huge benefit. So given all of that, this report represents almost an inflection point after 10 years of Oregon Inc. and really asks the question, how do we move forward with Oregon Inc.? It's been a great success. It's been the foundation of the state's innovation and entrepreneurship efforts. But we now, as a new team, are recognizing that so much has happened over the past 10 years, so much change in the economy and the technology-enabled aspects of the economy, that the report really takes a look at that. And I think that's what we want to share with you today. So those are just a few of my remarks in context, and then I want to turn it over to Kant for his perspective.
Good morning, Chair Reed and committee members. As Erin mentioned, I've been in this role since about April, and so this is relatively new for me, but it's been an interesting time to come in with the new department as well being created. I was very busy the past 10 years running my own company, so I wasn't that much involved with the innovation and the state's role in that. So it was interesting to look at it from that perspective, though I'm more focused on looking forward. It's been great just to observe and really ingest what's been done in the past. And I think while we've done a good job, I can say we can always do better. And that's really what we should be focusing on, is we've done a great job. Now we've built a good foundation. Now what can we do to create more jobs and increase wages in Oregon? Thank you.
So I'll briefly just walk through a few examples of our thought process going through this innovation plan. Some of the economic indicators that we looked at that really we present a lot of the data in terms of what happened a decade ago and then where are we today. So what does the world look like and what did it look like in 2005 when the first investments were made in the Oregon Innovation Council? What bets did we place then and what opportunities are available now that the world is a bit of a different place? And so change over 10 years, some notable ones are GDP in millions was the largest increase for our state and per
That's
capita
relative
GDP,
to other states or when you said largest?
This is relative. This is the change over 10 years. So this is the percent increase over 10 years.
Largest
just for
amongst
Oregon.
Within
the state. So some of the most marked increases are average earnings per job and state GDP per million and the per capita GDP have all gone, up significantly. And looking also at business trends, and I certainly you can dig through a lot of this, but I think the inflection point we realized when the Oregon Innovation Council itself and us and my staff at Business Oregon had this team looking at what do we really propose. We looked at the difference in the world in 2005 and realized that the iPhone hadn't even been invented until 2007. So we didn't have
stunning
social media. We didn't have apps. We didn't have the sharing economy. There was no Uber. People were still using Ethernet cables and sometimes dial-in to access the internet, and now we rank 14th in the country for broadband access. So a lot has changed, and we wanted to really respect that a lot has changed and not start placing early bets until we've really used the talent of the Innovation Council as a think tank and a thought leader board to really explore where we should go next. We worked closely with the universities to put their section of this together, and we've created a vice president or VP of research committee with all four of the research institutions on it. It's been a great success so far. It's been wonderful to have all four of them coming together to talk about collaborative efforts to forward research. And this was some of the outcomes of those early conversations with that committee, is picking sort of their clusters of excellence at each university, and it's explored a lot more in detail in the plan. We haven't forgotten about early education, STEM and CTE. You know, we looked at the Oregon Talent Plan, and this was just a quote from one of the council members. It says, today it's increasingly difficult to find points of separation between emerging industries, and is translating to education, to workforce, and entrepreneurship as well. The generation of children in school today are true digital natives. Most have never known a world without touch screens. We need to teach our kids to embrace failure as entrepreneurs do, as iteration. So if at first you don't succeed, try again. So we've got lots of quotes like this from board members on the council looking at the innovation economy. And looking at the Oregon Capital Scan, which the Growth Board also produces and will produce again in 2016, an updated version, nationally, access to capital is skyrocketing. If you look at the last column versus the 2009 column, we've recovered incredibly well from the recession. And the crowdfunding, that middle darker blue line, is the one that's really striking. That ramp up, that almost was non-existent in 2009, and it's a brand new source of capital for all kinds of entrepreneurs that were really underserved by the capital ecosystem in the past. This scorecard is a part of a larger, this is the snapshot of an innovation index that Business Oregon produces in our Economic Strategies and Policy Division. And it looks at things like patents, R&D, SBIR, and I just wanted, you can explore this yourself, but there's some notable ones that were somewhat surprising to us. I mean, I think we know how important manufacturing is to our GDP, but we're the second in the country as far as the importance of manufacturing to our GDP. And exports, we rank very high in exports, and patents, sixth in national rankings. And so there's the ability, as we go through some of these numbers, which is why I requested the longer time with you later, so that we can dig into these a little bit more. We can start spotting trends and spotting gaps in the ecosystem that we can fill, and build a strategy around that to grow some of these numbers, and looking at the impact they create after we grow them. SBIR being a notable one, 11th in the country and on a strong upward trend, and that's all non-dilutive research dollars that go to universities and private entrepreneurs, which is very important because it's early stage prototype money, and we've tried our hand a little bit at supporting SBIR, and I think there's opportunity to do a lot more with that and bring a lot more dollars into the state. So the first decade of Oregon Inc., the legislature, you charged the council with meeting 8 primary criteria: increasing wages, creating new jobs, improving research that leads its way to innovation, and improving access to capital, increase high-value Oregon exports, grow high-wage jobs that are linked also to rural industries, and build Oregon's global brand and sustainability, which is now, I think, in 2005, thought of as an industry in itself, and now permeates in everything that we do in the state of Oregon, and I don't think would be called an industry anymore. So building innovation capacity as well. And we did that traditionally through signature research centers and industry initiatives that the Oregon Innovation Council would invest in. And here's a little bit of a timeline on how those investments looked. It was just ONAMI for a couple of years, and then we had a 4-year period where we experimented a lot with manufacturing of metals, seafood, food processing, wave energy, bioscience, and sustainability and clean tech. And then later on, now we've emerged, as emerging industries come online, we've explored those as well with SOAR, with unmanned aerial systems and electric vehicles, and digital storytelling, like augmented reality, virtual reality, video, and gaming. So the exploration should continue. I think that was the spirit in which we were, that this council was intended, and we intend to get back to that. So a few things happened in 2015. So Governor Kate Brown appointed 12 new Oregon Inc. members out of 15. So it's a largely brand new board. A lot of terms ended right around the same time for whatever reasons. And we have a lot of new blood on the council, a lot of really great council members. And Oregon Inc. became a part of Business Oregon's base budget for the first time at $17.9 million. And the Oregon University System was dissolved in favor of independent governance, which affects us greatly when we think about research and commercializing it. I won't go into the structure. This was House Bill 2288 that came through this committee, and the structure really represents a more equal representation of investors, private industry people, and also state representatives from, like, the Talent Council and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, Treasurer, and those types, to get as many diverse seats at the table as possible. And this is the budget for 2015-17 that the legislature approved. And we have, if most notable is on the bottom, OWET and Drive Oregon are graduating out of the Oregon Innovation portfolio this year. And SOAR is funded to the level that it is to build out the test ranges to match other investments and to build out this nascent unmanned aerial systems industry here in Oregon. Some of the outcomes, we're starting to see a lot of touch points around other parts of the state. Are we done?
No, no, I just want to interrupt for just a second because Representative Wisner
has a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, how many ranges do we have now approved? Three, and where are they?
There is a range in Tillamook and one in Warm Springs and one in Pendleton. And all three are coming online. They all are exploring centers of excellence, which we should probably have a really interesting conversation about. But yes, there's three. And so some of the impact out of the $83 million overall that's ever been invested over the decade in Oregon Inc., that has leveraged $617 million in return on investment of 7-to-1. And that includes federal and industry research grants and private capital, created 90 new companies, created 471 newly created jobs, not even including retained jobs. And that's only over the five-year period, because that's as far as we track them inside Business Oregon. And then created and supported 11 shared public access labs that were used by over 300 companies. And so in these industries, that's a very valuable contribution. So some lessons learned on a national scale. The ingredients, as we look, we partner with SSTI, which is a national group that focuses on technology-based economic development, or TBED for short. And they're still pushing the envelope. There's a lot of exploration on how this is done at a state level. But the ingredients for an innovation ecosystem must include a research base that generates new knowledge, mechanisms to transfer that knowledge into the market, an entrepreneurial culture, and a diverse source of risk capital, and a technically skilled workforce. So we're looking at all of those ingredients. But internally, what we've learned, we took away three primary lessons with Oregon Inc. over the past 10 years, and that's that innovation and innovation policy is a long game, that it doesn't have a two-year graduation cycle sometimes, and that it's ecosystem building, so sometimes that takes longer. And innovation's unpredictable as well. You have to be agile and make decisions sometimes a little bit on the fly so that you can be opportunistic. And then Oregon Inc. needs improved data and impact metrics to really paint a picture of how this impacts, rather than, you know, bin number W-2 created jobs. How do we paint a more thorough picture of what's actually happening as a result of this? And the whole country and world, in fact, are chasing how to do that. So we don't have the answer, but we certainly are going to push the state of the art on that level. We're going into some strategic planning. Business Oregon is updating their target industries, and so Oregon Inc. will actually take a very serious look on how any applications that we receive for new industry initiatives fit into this mix. This was a very thoughtful process. It'll be reviewed and approved by the Business Oregon Commission in a couple of weeks, in a week or so. So it's not final, but it's certainly a roadmap to look at where our GDP is really being impacted and how innovation can feed into that. And going forward, we're focusing on partnerships, creating efficiencies within the budget that Business Oregon's been entrusted with. How can we create efficiencies within that, and what's the best use of those funds? And then create partnerships with universities, our corporate partners, government agencies, startups, nonprofits, even co-working spaces, maker spaces, and even those inventors in garages where a lot of our innovation comes from. So I appreciate your time, and I think, you know, there's an opportunity. I look forward to you reading it, and I think all three of us are available for any questions you may have if you wanted to reach out to us directly.
I think that's great. I appreciate you coming and giving us an orientation. I think it's likely we have an more extended conversation about this mm-hmm. when we're all together in February after you've had a chance to digest this. But this orientation and introduction to it is very helpful, at least to me. Are there any questions now before we come back for another opportunity?
Great starting point.
Very good. Representative Hayden, Representative Nierman, try to be a little quieter next time, please. not so much.
Oh, can I just ask one?
Yes, Representative Rudy.
I want to ask Mark's question. He's not here, but earlier we had a question about, you know, should the state just give you money and then just stay out of the way? Would you support that, or would you like more help from us? You don't have to.
It's a loaded question.
Yeah. You don't have to answer that.
I think the state has a role to play. It depends what kind of role it is. I think it's more in terms of ecosystem building than picking initiatives, and because the state, I think we can all acknowledge, is not as nimble as a lot of other smaller institutions. And just as you see in this, innovation is changing so rapidly. It's not static. And we shouldn't pick an initiative and continue to work on that. We should be willing to cut our losses. That's the hardest part. It's easy to make investments. It's hard to decide when to cut your losses and try something different. Yes. And I think that's what we need to really be thinking about.
Sounds like a man that's been there.
Well said. Well said. Thank you very much. We'll see you again
Thank
soon.
You.
And with that, unless there's anything else to come before the committee. Yes, I'm totally sorry. Yeah. I forgot. Representative Wisner has an update for us.
I'd just like to tell the committee, because one of the important bills we worked on in past was about the open education resources. And I attended the commission meeting on Monday. They're working real hard. Heck, people left. But they're doing a good job. It's really tough. And it's really we've identified the courses that are going to be looked at. And now the difficult question is who gets the money and how you give the money away. So the HEC will have to decide that. I think the committee, our intent was to, I expressed the committee's intent was that we use as much open source of, open source material as possible. There was some discussion in the commission meeting about creating material, and did you get some of the money for doing that? And do you get money for repackaging the model and stuff like that? But they're doing good work, and I think we're close to having a decision on 15 courses that will use the open source, can use the open source. And one thing they did real critical yesterday is this: they're going to submit a series. Like you could have Algebra 1, 2, 3 is one item. Because it uses the same textbook.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
Thank you for the update. Thank you for going and representing us. We really appreciate that. Please keep us posted.
Good job. You weren't here to hear that.
Yes.
That's one of the best things we did last.
Anything else for the committee? Thank you. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.